Welcome everyone to the final session of today's gathering, the agenda of which is that three very distinguished figures in the realm of politics, public life and education are here on this panel to talk a bit and perhaps to answer some questions about their views on the place of history in school education in England. And I'd like, if I may, to begin by introducing our three guests, though it can, of course, truly be said that they don't need any introduction. Kenneth Baker, an exceptionally distinguished career in government during the years of Thatcher and John Major as Minister for Information Technology, Secretary of State for the Environment, Secretary of State, of course, for Education at the time when the national curriculum was passed, subsequently Chairman of the Conservative Party and Home Secretary, and also, of course, author of a considerable number of extremely good, admirable works of history, in particular cartoon histories of Prime Ministers and monarchs. Secondly, Gordon Marsden, a historian as an undergraduate, subsequently, as many of you will know, editor for 12 years of History Today, MP for Blackpool since 1997, a junior minister during the Labour years in the Lord Chancellor's Department, DCMS, and the Department of Communities and Local Government, and now Shadow Minister for Further Education, Skills and Regional Growth, as well as being a trustee of the History of Parliament. And finally, on my left, Shirley Williams, of course, a major figure in the Wilson and Callaghan governments and Secretary of State for Education during the late 1970s, subsequently a hugely important figure in the founding of the Liberal Democratic Party, of which for a time she was leader in the House of Lords, and before, during and between that, a professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Between the three of them, they bring to bear a huge array of experience and expertise, and it's immensely good of them to have given up time to be with us this afternoon. So will you please join with me in welcoming our guests here now. Now, the way in which we are going to proceed, if that's all right, is that each of them, as it were, in alphabetical order, that's to say beginning with Ken Baker, then Gordon Marsden, then Shirley Williams, is going to speak for about 10 minutes on whatever subjects they think are of relevance and importance in terms of the subject of today's conference, I ought to say. So there will be some sense of relevance and limitation here. After that, we will open the floor to comments and questions and discussion. And then towards the end of the proceedings, I shall ask each of them to offer some closing remarks. I shall then try to offer some general reflections on the course of today's proceedings, after which we shall make the hazardous and difficult and challenging journey across the corridor to a reception at which the book will be launched. So that, as it were, is how we are going to proceed, if that's all right. So that being said, I'd like, if I may, to ask Ken Baker to begin. Ken.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's delightful to be with so many historians, because history was my first love. Your book is absolutely fascinating. It has one glaring error in it, in that it said that when at Oxford I studied law. Now, I didn't waste my time at Oxford. I studied history under very great historians. K.B. McFarlane, those who are medievalists will know what a great historian he was. Carl Leiser, another great medievalist. And John Stoy, who's still alive at 95, an 18th century historian, and A.J.P. Taylor. And so when it fell to me in the 1980s to shape the national curriculum, I wanted to ensure that history had a very important place in it. It was one of the subjects that I ordained at that time, or through legislation ordained, should be continued up to 16. And shaping the actual curriculum itself was, I knew, going to be difficult. I thought some subjects in that would be simple and easy and not controversial. I thought maths must be simple. But I soon discovered, even in maths, feudal armies walked and marched across the field. What should trigonometry be taught before 16 or not? Do you have to learn tables by heart or not? Should you allow calculators? And the venom and feeling was so great that various people resigned. I knew history was going to be difficult. So I appointed a man called Commander Saunders Watson, and I appointed him because he owned a castle. He was not a friend of mine, I didn't know him, but I went to Rockingham Castle and was very impressed with the quality of education that he was providing in the converted stable blocks. And I thought he had the right idea, that certainly chimed with my idea of history, and he produced history curriculum. It was delivered to the Prime Minister just after I'd moved on. That was a bit lucky, because he focused very much on understanding rather than knowledge, whereas the Prime Minister was clearly knowledge rather than understanding, and I think she won. But the whole idea of that curriculum was to provide a continuous story, a flow of where we came from. And I believe very strongly that all children at all in all countries and in all generations need to have an understanding of where they came from. And there are, you know, as historians, you'll know there are hundreds of quotations like that from Cicero onwards. So I think that's a very important thing for young children in our society, to know how the country in which they live has been shaped over the years. And, you know, I learnt my early history in the days of our Ireland story and our Empire story and Scotland story. And the only bits of Scotland story that I married a Scot, I still remember, are those personal stories of Bar the Door, Margaret, and things like that. I still remember. These things stick in your mind. And I know this is a bit old-fashioned to say, but certainly young children remember very much stories through an association with particular characters, particular events, dramatic events of one sort or another. And so where do we face today? I'm sure that Michael Gove probably told you this morning that as a result of him introducing the EBAC, that the number of young people studying for GCSEs history in 2013 has gone up to 39%, which is an increase of 8%. If he didn't give you those figures, I'm sure he should have given them to you. To give you further evidence of that, why that's happening, some of you may be aware that I'm spending my time now establishing new types of schools, university technical colleges, which are 14 to 18, specialising in technical education. 40% of the time below 16 is spent on technical, usually engineering or building works of one sort or another, and 60% academic. On the academic side, which is interesting for you, we do GCSEs in English, Maths and Science, and also history. History is there. And it's because I feel that, in fact, these youngsters who are specialising in engineering and science must have a feel of what has happened in those areas in the past in their own interests. And I spoke to the history teacher at Walsall, one of the ones that opened this year. I said, what are you teaching in history? And she said, there's one model we're doing, one part of the curriculum is the history of medicine. Apparently it's a very good course, very popular. And I said, the second, and here I groaned. She said, Nazism, the Holocaust, and Hitler. And I would actually ban that now as part of a series of studies. I think it does absolutely no good for our youngsters to go over that period again. It does no good for understanding of modern Germany for a start. Mm-hmm. And I think we should be more focusing on what's happening in our country. And the third part of her curriculum was British history from 1945 to today, which is a bit like current affairs, a bit like citizenship. One of the things I'm going to do for the technical colleges is to commission various courses in the lives of great scientists, inventors, designers, what the wheel has done to the world, what steam has done to the world. And I'm going to make these as visual as I can. I'm going to try and do it with the BBC, because I'm a great believer in making history more visual. Mm. There's a wonderful quotation embedded in your book by a lady I'd never heard of, a teacher from Sussex in 1910. I dare say you've never heard of her. Harriet Finlay Johnson. I don't know how you found out about her. But she believed in the dramatic method of pedagogy for history. A child learns and retains what he is learning better by actually seeing and doing things. I believe that very strongly indeed. Very, very strongly indeed. Seeing and doing. The colleges that I'm setting up are seeing and doing. They're proving to be very successful and very popular. In history and seeing and doing, the thing I would, in teacher training colleges, teach all history teachers to do, to acquire an absolute great facility in editing moving images. Now, I know many teachers do this, but I think that's an absolute historical skill, because there is so much in film and on television, that is historical, which can be used and engage the attention of the student. And I would hope that teachers would be able to, as it were, as easy as writing in a notebook, in fact, take bits out of films. If I was doing Henry VIII, for example, I would want to do a collation of the different interpretations of Henry VIII. I'd start with Charles Laughton, then I'd move up through them all, I would show him as a hero. I would show him as what Dickens described him, the biggest blot of blood and grease on the annals of our history. And I would get all the aspects, and people can make up their own minds. I'd also teach them a lot of history, the foundation of the Church of England, the great importance of the Reformation Parliament, and things of that sort. And I think they would remember by seeing it visually. And I think teachers have got to be able to do that themselves, not call some IT expert in, because the teacher will want to intersperse their own comments at each stage. Remember this, or make their own comments, as they would if they were writing their notes in a textbook. So I think that's one of the things that I would now do if I was Education Secretary. I would insist that all teachers of history, I'd go wider in history, I think teachers generally, should become really adept, so it's absolutely second nature for you to do that. Now, I do know editing is quite difficult, because I edit old gramophone records for verse and poetry, and I'm used to getting them off vinyl and putting them into CDs and tapes and things of that sort. And I know it's quite tricky, and unless you do it really regularly, you forget to press the wrong button at the right moment and all of that. I do know it's difficult. So you have to learn it so it becomes second nature. That's one of the changes I would make. What else would I do? I would somehow establish in our country a museum that tells the whole history of our country. Now, I had a go at this. Now, I know that what do you mean by our country? I'll come to that in a moment. But what happens on this island, if you like, and I would include Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland. And I had a go at this in the 1990s and got very far down the road, because the Millennium Commission were going to give the group that I set up, with very distinguished historians, and all party, Dennis Healy, Roy Jenkins, everybody, £50 million to establish a museum in the hospital that's about to be closed in Barts. And we'd got even to the stage of agreeing the curriculum. It was a very, very ambitious project, going to cost much more than £50 million. But it was going to happen, because I wanted every young child in our country to visit that museum twice, in their primary and in their secondary. I wanted to do that because on a visit to Mexico, I only visited Mexico once in my life, but there is a great museum outside Mexico City, which is a UNESCO center, and I was so impressed with it, because it was full, when I was there, very beautifully arranged open-air museum, with hundreds and hundreds of young Mexicans learning about pre-Columbian history and post-Columbian history. And you could see they were fascinated. We have no museum like that in our country, none whatsoever. I'm amazed that we don't have one just doing the political history of our country. That is a story in itself, and it conditions our life today, every day. You know, the freedoms that we have, the liberties we enjoy, how they were won and gained. It's a wonderful thing. And I wanted to recreate all that, the debate between Pitt and Fox, the debates between Disraeli and Gladstone, the debates between Ira and Bevan and Ian MacLeod, the debates between Margaret Thatcher and Neil Kinnock. Make them recreate them, make them interesting and lively. And so I would try to do that again if I was Education Secretary. It would be hard going, but I think that's needed in our country, because I want everybody to share that experience, and particularly those people who've come to our country recently. The flow of immigrant groups over the century has been one of the enduring strengths of our country over the centuries, and I think, why do they want to come here? Because it's our history has created a place where they want to live, and so I think they should be aware and engage in that history. So that's what I'd be trying to do today, because I do think that it's very important to give all our young people today, particularly in a society which is partly multicultural, a sense of where they have, what our country has come from and the enduring strengths that make it such an attractive place. Thank you.
Kent, thank you very much indeed. Good. In that case, I think, Gordon, it's over to you.
Right. Well, thank you very much, David. And can I first of all start by saying it's an absolute delight to be here this afternoon to receive the authorised version, which has been placed on everybody's seat. And already, as always, you're making waves with the new book, and that's absolutely great. And it's also a great delight and a great privilege to be on the platform with two people who I admire enormously for their contributions in the field of education and history, and that's obviously Shirley Williams and Ken Baker. And Ken mentioned the Museum for British History, and when I was editor of History Today in the 1990s, I was very pleased and proud to play a part in that campaign. And it's a great shame, as Ken said, that thus far it's not come to fruition. I was struck, Ken, very much by what you were saying about bringing the drama to history and bringing history alive and giving historians all the right technical abilities. A mischievous thought passed through my mind. Of course, I don't know how many people here have seen the famous play Lettuce and Lovage, which is about an over-enthusiastic interpreter of a National Trust property who invents an alternative history for it. And one would obviously have to curb some enthusiasm in that area, but I absolutely agree. The other point, and I suppose it shows that things don't change that much. Before I came here today, I decided it would be useful to go down memory lane, and I dug out a book that was published shortly after I became editor of History Today in the mid-1980s, edited by my predecessor, Juliet Gardner. It was called The History Debate, and indeed, for all I know, there may be one or two contributors to it here. And of course, it was produced just at the time when all of the ferment of activity around the national curriculum, which you were intimately involved with, Ken, was coming forth. And I was struck, I was going to quote this anyway, but I was struck particularly, if I ought to quote it now, you just having said what you said, by the introduction to the essay that was written by the late Roy Porter, who in himself was an enormous contributor to the popularisation, but not the bastardisation of history. And that is always the balance I think we need to strike. What Roy said in his essay, he said, "For the health of history, it's crucial that historians, no less perhaps than the acting profession, recognise their responsibilities to meeting public needs and equally their duty to cultivate good communication skills. Otherwise, we will be treated with deserved contempt as being guilty of a prissy dereliction of duty." So that's very, very much vintage Roy Porter. But what I thought it would be useful and helpful just for me to say, apart from my own views as to where we should go now, and I should stress, I need to stress, that I speak in a personal capacity today, so I'm not making up Labour Party policy on the hoof. I'm giving my views as someone who's been involved with this process, as you referred to, David, for a good 20 years, and has seen many of the twists and turns of it. But I thought it might be useful just for me to outline two periods in the past where I think this has been a particular ferment, and to say why I think both of those points are highly relevant today. The first, obviously, is the debate that swirled around the establishment of national curriculum in the late 80s and what sort of history you should have in it. And Ken, you exempted yourself, and if you hadn't, I would have exempted you equally from the idea that you ever intended, or indeed for that matter the government at the time, ever intended that it should be entirely a fact-driven curriculum. And I think there was a great deal of barren argument in that period between the value of skills and the value of facts. And the truth is you can't have decent skills unless you've got a factual basis on which to proceed and everything that goes with it. But I only mention that today because it seems to me that although one might have thought that particular dragon had been dispatched some 20-odd years ago, it still twitches and it's still alive and kicking, and sometimes it appears in curious forms, even in long-standing professional historians who ought to know better. But it is, I think, worth making the point that just as you cannot have a decent interpretation of history for whatever purpose you want it to be unless you have a factual base and knowledge and context, so it is equally worth making the point that you can't do skills and empathy and all the other things that we've talked about so strongly in the 1990s unless you have that factual base. And that is, I think, in every twist and turn of the debate about the national curriculum, that is something we should keep very much to the fore. And I went back again to a number of the articles I commissioned in History Today in the late 1980s when this was going on, and I was struck by what Sally Perkis wrote at the time. She headed it with that wonderful quote from Khrushchev, Khrushchev's view that was historians are dangerous people, they are capable of upsetting everything. And it seems to me that goes very nicely with the very sardonic one that dates from the period, the Soviet period in Russia, which I can't remember who it was ascribed to, but it was the rather famous aphorism, the past is always changing, only the future is certain. And of course the past is always changing as part of academic debate, apart from totalitarian changes that might come along the way. But again, I think what Sally said, as I say, nearly a quarter of a century ago now, is still highly relevant to everything we discuss today. She said the skills of the historian, the evaluation and interpretation of evidence, are a particularly relevant preparation for adult life in a democracy, where one is required to recognise the shortfalls of propaganda and participating in full decision making. Now that was said before the web, before Wikipedia, before Twitter, before any of the things that today make that comment even more relevant. It seems to me that the whole virtual world, the online world, is the 21st century's equivalent of the fruit in the Garden of Eden, and of course is potentially usable for great good, as we've seen with the changes, the Arab Spring and everything else, as well as potentially great distortion. So I think some of these arguments which were made at that period are still highly relevant. Now, I want to deal briefly with the period which I was particularly involved with, the debate about history, from a sort of policymaker point of view, which was really between about 2004 and 2009, when I was asked, initially by Charles Clarke, but subsequently by Andrew Adonis and a number of other ministers subsequent to that, to chair an informal advisory history group to the department. And I think, Charles got a lot of flack, some of you may remember, for supposedly having said things about medieval history. He always insisted to me, and indeed to other people, that he'd been, as politicians so often are, misquoted, and actually what he was going on about was not the uselessness of medieval history, but the uselessness of looking at history from a purely sort of enclosed medieval perspective. I didn't think I'd entirely let him off, of course, because some of the best clerics and historians of the Middle Ages were also great public figures, but there we are. But anyway, so I was asked to do this job, and I think very much his view, and the view possibly still of ministers, was that it was very important that they had an outside perspective of historians working in the field, and that outside perspective should be as broad as possible. This is not to denigrate in any sense the work of civil servants within the department, and certainly not to denigrate the work done by Ofsted or HMIs. HMIs in particular have played a very, very important part in contribution to this debate over the last 20 years. But there was a sense, I think, that there needed to be a sense of outside thinking all the time. And so that was what we tried to bring to that debate. And I think particularly with Andrew as education minister, where, of course, he constantly, as all ministers, in my view, have to do, however enthusiastic they are for history, he constantly had to sign the self-denying ordinance and not actually do the sort of, I would like to see X, Y, and Z. And if I have a criticism of Michael Gove, and again, I feel sometimes that Michael is a little bit like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, because on good days, he comes over as a model of sort of thoughtfulness, plurality, and all the rest of it, and on other days, somewhat less so. But what I think the challenge, and it's a great privilege to have a Secretary of State who is so interested in history, genuinely is, I mean that quite sincerely. But, of course, as I say, he needs to remember, and all elected politicians need to remember, that there has to be a self-denying ordinance. Otherwise, you end up with a system where you're all, I know it's a caricature, but where you're all teaching the same thing at 3:10 and a school somewhere and wherever. Or you end up with a situation where the twists and turns of the history curriculum are entirely dependent on the twists and turns of the individual occupying the office of Education Secretary, and that would not be a good thing. So I welcome the fact that this debate has yet again been reopened. But I do hope, and I do caution, that we do not, as a result of that, go back to some version of our Ireland story. And as I say, from time to time, this element of conflict of Jekyll and Hyde, it seems to me, comes out. What I want to see is what I think remains relevant from the discussions that we had as a group in the 2000s, and indeed I think particularly when Gordon Brown became Prime Minister. Gordon Brown, for all the other comments that might be made about his premiership, had a very strong sense of the urgency of understanding Britain's history. That was one of the reasons why he had a personal interest in the idea of a museum of British history. It didn't come to fruition for a range of reasons, but nevertheless there was that interest there. And I think that one of the debates that we need to have is how we achieve that sense of the connectedness of British history to the sort of 21st century world we inhabit, the sort of 21st century plural identity, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multi-racial Britain we inhabit, without in any way destroying the traditional, and it must always remain this, the traditional autonomy of historians and academics. And it seems to me that this is particularly relevant if we're going to have a debate about the curriculum and the place of history in it, and whether it's 16 or anything else, because one of the things that I felt in the early 2000s, and the select committee I served on did a major inquiry on citizenship education, which I prompted them to do, and one of the things I felt at the time was that this endless fight over getting space in the curriculum for history and all the rest of it was disguising the fact that we actually had a potential means of delivering history very broadly, but nevertheless with a narrative framework, and that was via citizenship, and citizenship that is done potentially by everyone at the secondary level. Now, we produced a select committee report. We talked very strongly about the report that Keith Ayewa produced for the government, where he recommended that actually a historical core over the last 200-250 years, but pulling back on all sorts of other earlier periods of British history should be included. Not just who do we think we are, but how do we think we got to where we are today? And it still seems to me that that would be a mechanism for making sure, because from my point of view, I want as many people to enjoy history as possible. And of course, you know, there is no doubt about the popularity of history in the public domain and all the rest of it. But I also want history to be a vital building block in understanding how this country has come to be the way it is, where it is in the world, so that we don't have a narrow Our Island story presentation, and an understanding also of the pluralities of history and the pluralities of interpretation. Because without that, some of the skills that we need to rub along as a 21st century Britain, whether it's in the world or whether it's in our own country, I think will be lost. So it's not to me a debate about narrow things, important though they may be, as to whether history in the curriculum stops at 14 or 16, but what sort of history we can teach to as broad a range of people as possible that will have a social utility, as well as for all the love of the subject and everything else that I take as a given, and I certainly take that as a given and is an important element in lifelong learning. My own particular responsibilities with further education now make me feel this even more sharply, because although the debate inevitably talks about school and it talks about history to 14 or 16, there is a whole changing world out there of teaching, as Ken has illustrated by the things he said about the UTCs. And I just think it is extremely important that whatever we do with history, that we reach the broadest range of people as possible, and that includes people in vocational education across the piece, not just the excellent stuff that you may be putting into your UTCs. So I'll conclude there and just say that I think we have great opportunities to disseminate history more broadly, much more widely than we've ever had before, with the internet, with online, and everything goes with it. We have a period where we are open-minded on this, but we also have, I think, a very strong civic imperative, with all the complications and tensions of our modern world, to deliver a view of British history and Britain in the world as widely and as broadly as possible, And I think it's very important that we do that, that we don't get too tied up, although it's always very tempting, into narrower points about where we should stop history in a curriculum at a particular point.
Gordon, thank you so much. That raises, as of course did Ken's remarks before that, a whole set of issues which I'm sure members of the audience will want to take up with you. But before that, we're hugely looking forward to hearing from Shirley Williams. Shirley.
Thank you very much. I've just ended 10 years as being the chairman of judges of the teaching awards system, and that gave me, if nothing else had ever done so, but I think other things had done so, a huge respect for the profession of teaching. One of the things that I always found inspiring about teaching awards was the extraordinary enthusiasm of so many teachers, both for their subject and for their pupils, and that left me, and still in fact from time to time excites me, with a sense of what a rich profession this is and how great its potential can be. So I'm going to talk a bit about some of the ways in which I think that secretaries of state could build on that and haven't always done so. But before I do so, let me just say three things about my fellow panellists. The first is that I've always vastly enjoyed reading History Today, and I enjoyed it very much in its from its beginning, because one of the great things about History Today as a magazine was that it had this amazing capacity for discovering how innovative history is. If you read History Today, you suddenly discovered aspects of maybe the fight against slavery, or the American Civil War, or some other aspect of history which you thought you knew and discovered that you had only begun to understand. It had this amazing capacity for turning a searchlight on some of the less known areas of history and creating in it, therefore, an astonishing marriage between innovation and history itself. With regard to Ken, I haven't always agreed with him, but on one thing I wish him the very best, and that is that I think what he's embarking upon in the case of the University Technical Colleges addresses the great big Achilles heel of the whole of education in this country. When I was the Minister of State to Tony Crossland, we tried to embark upon something a bit like Ken is doing at the university level by creating polytechnics. The purpose of polytechnics being, of course, that they would address both local research needs and also applied research needs. They rapidly turn into a new group of universities. That was never the intention, and in my view it has been a tragedy for British education that that's what happened, because it left again the Achilles heel out there, undealt with, unregarded, passed by, because all the way through English education, much more than Scottish education, there's been this total failure to recognise that you can have great quality and great excellence in applied knowledge. And I think that that has been one of our great problems and remains one of our great problems, and so I wish him very well. And I hope that the university technical colleges will influence the universities as much as they influence the schools. Finally, I have one little tiny argument to have with David, and I warned him already, a great historian that he is, and that is that I found it rather painful, and I have read a substantial part of his remarkable book, and it's a very, very interesting book. But I was sad to see that among the very large majority of totally second-rate secretaries of state, and I expected to appear myself, but I was rather shocked to find Tony Crossland in that group, because one of the two things I can say about Tony Crossland, the first is that undoubtedly he had a very great influence on education, as great an influence as any other secretary of state ever has had. And secondly, that he was somebody who cared profoundly about education. And if anybody read the book called that he wrote in the 50s called The Future of Socialism, whether they're socialist or not, they will recognise that there is this intense belief that it's only by bringing about greater equality of opportunity in education that you can actually change society into being one of greater solidarity and one of greater aspiration. And that was something he cared about very much, because he recognised, as Ernest Bevin had recognised years before him, that one of the great weaknesses of England is that it's not a country of aspiration. It's a country which recognises quality, which recognises excellence, but through many, many parts of our society, aspiration is something that belongs to other people. And that's something that education has to address. Now let me break in fact, let me commit the sin that Gordon referred to in his own speech, which was to say, you shouldn't go back to saying, if I was Secretary of State, I would. I'm going to do exactly that. What would I do if I was Secretary of State today, all these years later? And there, you will see the relevance to history, because I'm going to be fairly controversial, not partisan, but controversial. I think that the first thing I would do would be to directly address and challenge what I can only describe as the depressing, in some ways, the deplorable hegemony of the examination system. I think the examination system in England particularly has now become so universal, so constant in every part of schools, directing how teaching happens, directing how the curriculum is dealt with, directing children away from the excitement of imagination and of thinking for oneself, that I actually believe they have become counterproductive. I think I would get rid of AS levels right away. AS levels, in my view, ruin the 1 year for secondary school young people when they could actually let their minds run free, when they could innovate, when they had the time to think, when they had the time to work on aspects of history that really excited them, that set flames in their minds. And now what do? They have to go through yet another damned educational examination, a perfectly pointless one, in my view. Secondly, I would address A-levels. I've never been an enthusiast for A-levels. In fact, I will openly state here, though it never got any publicity, that right back in 1977, when I was Secretary of State, I came out in favour of the International Baccalaureate. Why? For two reasons. The first of those was because holistic. I liked the fact that it addressed so many aspects of knowledge in such an exciting way. And secondly, and here I would completely support what Professor Richard Evans said this morning when I was here for the early part of this very interesting conference, that you cannot live in a multicultural, multiracial society without having some constant contribution from the histories of those other countries of which your country is now part. So, for example, I think that we should have, as part of the history of England, some recognition of the history of India, the history of Africa, the history of China. Now, that sounds mad. I know there's no time in the curriculum. But I've seen, particularly in some of the most exciting English primary schools, the way in which teachers have used things like Eid as the great Muslim festival, Diwali as the great Hindu festival, as a way of exciting their children in these other cultures and the ways in which they are now part of English culture, which is a very, very big patchwork quilt. I completely agree with what Ken said about the way in which one can enliven the teaching of history by pulling in other media. I think it works both ways. One of the reasons for the obsession of our examining boards with Hitler is because Hitler comes through the film and IT and television media, and they excite children because the children can immediately reflect into a visual image or a oral image of Hitler. But as good history, it isn't. Because unless you know something about the unification of Germany under Bismarck, something about the First World War and Versailles in particular, and something about the Weimar Republic, Hitler coming out of the blue, so to speak, is going to seem like, indeed, like an exciting introduction of aliens in a television program. It's not really history. History has to show how the past in Germany led to the present in Germany and will partly colour the future of Germany. And again, I agree very strongly with Ken Baker that reading about the Holocaust, dreadful though it is, I'm not saying one shouldn't do it, but in a context in which Germany is treated as a kind of separate country to deal with, leaves no understanding of modern Germany, the most transformed nation in Europe, with our children, and it's vital what they have. I think also that we need to use in primary school one of the things that the BBC has given us, which in my view is a very exciting thing. Some of you will have seen that series, I've only seen part of it, of history, the history of objects as a way of approaching history. Mm. I think this is wonderful for primary school, because one of the things it enables teachers to do is, in a sense, to have flashcards which show an object, an artifact, and start asking seven-year-olds where they think it comes from. Where did fireworks come from? Good question for Guy Fawkes Day. Not just what was the history of it, who was Guy Fawkes, but who invented fireworks? My goodness, it turned out to be China. What a marvellous thing for youngsters aged 7 or 8 to learn. And you could go on with that marvellous programme, The History of Objects, taking children as young as primary school, even early primary school, and I believe tremendously exciting them. They can go out and find objects, bring them in, and again ask questions about where they came from. And I very much agree with Kathy, who I was strongly supporting from the audience, with what she said about the capacity of quite young children at primary school to have astonishing levels of curiosity, excitement, and willingness to learn, often much more than the early stages of secondary, in areas of this kind, so they have a foundation which is much wider than kings and queens. Something about secondary, well, I've already been brutal about the subject of examinations. I don't like A-levels, I've said that already, I like IB. But above all, what I would like to see in education, and not least in history, is an increasing taming of the hegemony of the examination system. I think we really need the opportunity. I think it was Mr. I tried to remember the gentleman this morning who talked about the need to have 2 hours a week for 3 years to try to get a true picture of history, a continuing picture of history through. And I think that's broadly right. And that's going to fall, I think, in the late years of primary and the early years of secondary, because let's be honest, the 11 to 14 group is the most distracted group of all the pupils that we have, the ones most likely to think about other things while they're plying their way through the necessary levels that they're expected to get. But I think older and younger children are both much more capable of sustained and excited study. Finally, two more controversial things. First, I'd like to see rather more emphasis on what used to be called, and still is sometimes called, the HMIs. Because one of the great things about HMIs was that they were advisors and not just inspectors. I think Ofsted has become, in many ways, too, too interfering in terms of what it expects teachers to do. The great thing about HMIs, and I think that Ofsted is managing to move gradually in that direction, was that they would sit down and talk about the nature of the content of the subjects one was teaching. In a way, I think was much less true of Ofsted in its early years, when it saw itself essentially as a kind of inspector general. Last of all, going back again to something that Gordon said, and also I think that Kenneth said, I absolutely agree that one of the things one needs to do is to track down, in the case of the history of England, some of the continuing themes about it. And I always remember in the back of my head the wonderful remark of Macaulay that Britain was about broadening down from precedent to precedent. Absolutely right. It's a marvellous remark. And somehow what one has to do is to teach children the difference between evolution and revolution, to get them to ask the question why it is that since 1688 England has been a revolution-free patch, maybe not lasting much longer, but it's still been true up to now, whereas other countries, most other countries, have gone through major revolutions, and to teach them something at least about the high cost of revolution in terms of human happiness, whether it's Mao or Stalin or Hitler. Concentrating just on Hitler means you forget Mao and Stalin. Mm-hmm. But this is a constant human theme, not a specifically German theme. It's a frightening constant human theme, and it could happen here. And then on evolution, huge piece of luck for our country, but also one or two questions about how much evolution can begin to equal stick in the mud if we don't give it some kind of dynamic about where it needs to go to. And here again I would applaud the references to freedoms, to freedom of expression, to human rights, which I think they may call that, but which remain as constant themes, rather like the theme in a fine concerto of the English experience. Very last thought of all, don't rule out, I think, the contribution of other subjects to history. I tend to be on the same side as the speakers in today's teachers panel, all but one of them at least, in thinking that other disciplines can contribute to history. And I'll give you only one example. I don't think I ever really had any strong sense of the Middle Ages, although I studied it in a kind of half-hearted way, until I read that wonderful poem by Auden called The Age of Faith, which begins, "In that ago when being was believing, faith was the sum of many credibles." It brought to me that poem more than anything I learned from teachers about history, a sense of what the Middle Ages were all about, the extraordinary power of cathedrals, churches, and of course in the Muslim world, mosques, over the way that history was shaped, which one can easily lose. And that's the point at which I'll stop talking about what I would like to have done, because I shan't be able to do it.